Ms. Tobias, how much time did you wish to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Okay. Let me give counsel just a minute to set up.
Thank you.
Ms. Tobias, have you both signed in, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Marie Dolores Jackson. This is our appeal of the denial of the trial court's denial of our motion for entry of an order acceptable for processing and reimbursement of benefits as a result of the incorrect order that was entered. And I'd like to start with the point, Your Honor, that I believe the court indicated that these orders were not inconsistent on their face. That was the main finding of the court as the basis of its denial.
Counsel, not to jump in so early, but yes. Doesn't it come down to whether the second order is defined as a quadro under the statute or not?
I don't believe that was in dispute. I believe that it's clearly the sole purpose of the order is to award her the benefit under the military pension that she was awarded in the final decree.
But why? The second order, was entered while the court had jurisdiction over the entire matter. Is that correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Why can't your argument seems to be premised on or based on the premise that the trial court can't amend the initial order, he can only implement it. Is that?
When it is an order that is for the sole purpose of awarding a retirement benefit.
But that is an argument that is valid if the second order is entered post 21 day under 2107.3. But why can't a trial judge amend an order any way he or she sees fit as long as he has jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I believe that the purpose of 20-107.3K is that when we enter into final decree, we're dividing retirement benefits. And then we need to sometimes enter these retirement orders to effectuate that. But we don't know how they're always going to be interpreted by the agency or the entity that's receiving them. We also don't know how those orders will then be effectuated.
But this order was agreed to by counsel. The court had jurisdiction. The parties agreed to it. How can we tell the trial court that it was wrong to enter it?
I don't think that it was wrong to enter it. There's a distinction there, Your Honor. I believe that when that order was then processed and it was effectuated, it ended in a result that did not effectuate the final decree, that the court maintains authority to correct that issue. And the issue here is I was not allowed to present the evidence of that discrepancy and of that issue. I direct the court's attention to the Craig case, and I understand that the facts are different in the sense that it was an interpretation of a term in the order, but that was a consent order as well. These retirement orders are often entered as consent orders and often entered simultaneously with the final decree.
But is it what governs 20-107 in terms of what makes it a quadro is that it is outside of that period of time of which the trial court has jurisdiction to modify or change the orders.
I don't think that's its sole purpose, Your Honor.
I'm not saying its sole purpose. I'm simply saying, isn't that a part of what distinguishes it?
Absolutely. And I think, as I've said in my brief, I think the purpose of that is because we don't necessarily know how these things are going to play out once the order is processed.
How can it be a modification or a change to the court's order, though, in terms of under 20-107, if it's done within the 21 days where the court has the opportunity to modify and change orders?
Again, Your Honor, what I would submit to the court is let's envision a scenario in which, again, these orders get entered at the same time all of the time. Final decree and retirement orders submitted all at the same time. All parties, all attorneys believing at the time that retirement order is submitted that it is going to effectuate the final decree.
But my question is, isn't it the purpose of 20-107 so that whenever you've got the quadro, that you're not modifying or changing or upending the order that the court has previously entered?
Yes, and I believe that applies even before the 21 days.
What authority does the trial court have, now that 21 days has passed, to change that order?
To change the final order or to change the retirement order?
To change the last order entered while it had jurisdiction. See, I disagree with your characterization of the orders, but he entered a second order.
Correct.
21 days ran. He said, that order is exactly what I intended to enter. What jurisdiction does he now have to change it?
I believe the jurisdiction exists under 20-107.3.
But 2107.3 specifically says he can't change it. He can only effectuate it.
Effectuate what was included in the final order, which I believe is the final order of divorce.
The final order is the last order entered while the court has jurisdiction.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that there is statutory authority under 20-107.3 and under 20-91 to enter a final order of divorce, which is what was done in this case. And then there's additional authority granted to the court under 20-107.3 to effectuate a retirement order pursuant to that. And that is the distinction between these two orders.
Wouldn't you agree that the court had the authority initially to say, I intend to divide this pension up in such a way that the wife gets her share of the pension as it exists now? I do not intend to award her any cost of living benefits that might accrue in the future. Could he have done that?
Well, I don't think in this case, because an agreement was reached. This is a situation where these parties entered into an agreement. There were no factual determinations.
But the agreement was the final order. That's what they agreed to. Agreement was the last order entered. They agreed on that order. The court says, that's how I want to divide the pension. That's how I intended to divide the pension.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I submit to the court that the only basis to enter an order dividing a retirement, we can call the order whatever we'd like, but it is an order dividing a retirement. The only jurisdiction to do so is under 20-107.3K.
That's what your focus is.
Correct.
It's not the final decree of divorce, is it?
Not for my purposes, Your Honor. Is that the only jurisdiction?
You have a final decree that is to be reflected in the retirement order.
Correct.
It's the retirement order that you are quarreling, arguing, does not reflect what the judge's order on the divorce states.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the reason you can even attack it is because of 20-1073K.
Yeah, that is correct.
And that's procedurally where you are.
That is, Your Honor. And
okay.
that's the only statute that gives authority to enter that order.
I don't think there is a contention that the court didn't have jurisdiction to under 107.3, but maybe I mistake something. The argument has nothing to do with jurisdiction.
That was my understanding that
that should the court do now that it has all this great power.
Right, and that was my understanding of that was not an issue in contention.
I don't think it's an issue, but I think there's plenty of other things that are in contention that are a little bit more complicated, but I just want to be sure I understood that. So maybe I missed something.
No,
but you were really focused on something that the court, the divorce decree said.
That's
which
correct.
Which is where you find the percentage.
Yes, Your Honor.
Statement for one thing, which is among the arguments.
And this is why we took the position that the two orders are inconsistent on their face, unlike the court's ruling. I started with the case of Zip versus Zip. Appreciate and understand that these are cases where they took a present value of a future benefit and made a lump sum. But it is still comparable to this case because what the court said in the Zip matter is that you can't take what will be a future benefit that will change and that could increase or could decrease or could change over time and make it into a fixed sum in the present. And so just looking at these two orders on their face, they're inconsistent in that sense.
You seem to be arguing, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is you're arguing that the court's only authority to divide or award a portion of the pension comes under subsection, is pursuant to subsection K of the statute. Is that what you're arguing?
I think the court in a final order can set forth an award.
The court can divide a pension.
Yes, Your Honor.
Absent subsection K.
Yes, I would agree with that statement.
So subsection K only applies after the court loses jurisdiction.
I disagree because a final order dividing that military pension was entered, and the sole purpose of the second order was to divide that military pension for purposes of sending to...
Subsection K starts out with, the court shall have continuing authority and jurisdiction. That to me means after the 21 days has run.
Well, I think the fact that it continues assumes that it was also jurisdiction within those 21 days.
The jurisdiction, I don't have it in front of me. I made a copy of it late last night. I won't tell you what time. Therefore, I forgot it this morning. But I got the idea that the issue is amending. It's the power to amend. And, you know, not every order, not every action by a trial court carries with it the idea that it can be amended, notwithstanding the passage of time, whether it's a jurisdictional... I don't think it's limited to time.
And it says continuing, so I believe it's before the 21 days, I think it's after the 21 days.
Yes. I think the court can have continuing jurisdiction without ever losing it. There are plenty of child and divorce cases in which jurisdiction, particularly custody, and it doesn't have to end in order for jurisdiction to continue. That's the way I read 107.
Counsel, if you want to answer Judge Annunziata's question, I realize you're
in the rebuttal. Do you agree with that it continues?
I do agree that it continues.
Notwithstanding that it has never ended.
And then I agree that it continues, and I think the next question then becomes when there is an issue with how these orders are then processed and whether they effectuate what's in the final order of divorce.
And your position is that that very fact that a percentage was provided for in the decree and a specific amount was provided in the retirement order, they're not consistent.
They're not consistent on their face, and then the question becomes, what's the burden? What does the court do to try to determine whether or not the inconsistency is reconciled in what happened in between those two orders? And I would submit to the court that it is typically
with two contracts, the court looks at the language of the contract and determines the meaning, significance, and import from the four corners of each document. That's it.
And counsel, if you wish to answer the question and then reserve the rest of your time,
sure,
you may.
Sure.
Isn't that the legal
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, you have to tell us why that wasn't enough here, because that's what I think the court did.
Well, the issue is this, is that I disagree respectfully that the retirement order is part of that agreement. The issue is, it's one or the other. Either they are part of the same agreement, and although I respectfully disagree, if that's the case, then I think parole evidence should have come in to help determine whether that inconsistency is actually not an inconsistency based on the evidence of how that calculation was done. Or it's just an order to effectuate the final order, and therefore it's not parole evidence, but it's relevant as to whether that's an appropriate
proper order.
I'm
going to ask a very quick
order.
Question, but not ask you to answer it until you're in your rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But if that second order was wrong, was improper, did you have to appeal that within 30 days after its entry? Think about it and address it in rebuttal.
I will. Thank you.
No rest for the weary.
Counsel.
Good morning. Thomas Worley here on behalf of Dennis Jackson. Good morning to the court. I was very intrigued by the questions the court was asking a moment ago, so I want to go off script to just address that, if I may. You know, it's something, I started practicing before this statute, 2107.3, came into existence, and I've watched the unfolding of its interpretation since that time with great interest. And you've actually given me a chance to speak about something that I never thought I would ever get to address. 2107.3K4, I think the legislative intent may not have been nearly as broad as everyone has been taking it. When I read the language in 2107.3K4, which is the pertinent provision, it's the very last two words of that language that make me wonder what it says, that the court has the opportunity to make modifications to express the intent of the order, and it does not define what the order is. When I first read this statute, and for years beyond that, as I was watching this unfold, I thought that it meant that it gave the power to the court, the trial court, the power to modify the order that divides the pension, to make sure that the pension authority could process it. In other words, if you wrote an order and you sent it to the pension authority and then they said, no, we can't process this because of some defect in your language, you've included something you shouldn't or you've excluded something that must be there, then it gave the trial court the power to reform that order so that the pension authority could process it and pay the pension. What's happened is there's case law now that is linking those two words with the final decree or the property settlement.
There's case law on that?
Yeah, well, I believe that there is.
Or is that just argument?
No, I think that I will give good faith suggestion to opposing counsel. I think has done an excellent job in this. And in fact, the Craig case, as you know, was a case that she argued before this court. And I'll circle back around to a different argument that I have about the Craig case. So I think the courts have said, as of late, that the final decree sort of drives the quadro. And I'm not sure that that's accurate. And in fact, in this case, this is a very interesting case for the court to kind of fill in the interstices. You know, I think I was taught
counsel, not to interrupt you, but how would you define that second order? Would you define it as an order that the court entered within the 21 days that's not anything other than a simple order involved with the divorce, or is it a quadro?
Well, a quadro, the term quadro we use loosely.
I understand it's a term of art, but...
It is a term of art that derives from ERISA, Employment Retirement Income Security Act 1974, which only pertains to private pensions. So taking this more broadly, I think I would give credit to this. I would say that order was meant to divide a military pension. That's what it says right on its face. I think there's still, I see the question that you have, and I don't know that I know the answer to that perfectly, which I think is why you're asking the question, by the way. But I think that this statute does apply to that order, if that's the point of the question. But I think where we may have gotten off track with the question about how to interpret these orders, first, I wanted to say that these two orders were entered almost simultaneously. They were sent in with the same cover letter. I'm sure the trial judge read them both, signed them both, and that was that. So they were virtually simultaneous. And in fact, who knows what order they were signed in? The presumption is that the final decree was signed first and then the order that divides the military pension. So in Virginia, properly, we have imported contract law into the equation where, and it's under 20-155, where the parties reach agreement. So this was not a case where there was a trial and the judge made a decision and made a ruling. This is a case where the parties reached an agreement privately. First, it was at a commissioner's hearing where a very brief sketch of their agreement was made, and then these two orders were presented. And the language in each of the three places is different. But under 20-155, which I think is critical in this case, and even though I don't know if we ever even get to that because of the procedural and proof problems that there were in the case, but 2155 does not distinguish between orders that grant the divorce and orders which divide the pension. And I don't think that issue has ever been decided by the court.
What does it say?
2155 says that if parties reach an agreement for the purpose of settling the rights and obligations that pertain to both of them, that there are two ways that you can settle that. Beside having a formal property settlement, you can either enter an agreed order signed by counsel, or you can put your agreement on the record under oath. Both of those things were done.
Let me ask you the question that I left Ms. Tobias with. Suppose that, and I'll call it the second order.
Yes, sir.
Was entered and it was totally inconsistent with the agreement of the parties. The agreement of the parties clearly indicated that wife gets cost of living benefits under the pension.
Absolutely.
Court order says wife gets no cost of living benefits under the pension. Mm-hmm. Can the wife appeal that second order 5 years after it was entered?
I don't think she can appeal it, but I think that it is correct. For example, if it said the wife gets 50% of the pension and then the next order says the wife gets 40% of the pension, those two are inconsistent. And so then, and by the way, this is a very important reason, since we've imported contract law into Virginia law to address this issue, that means all of contract law is available. And you may have noticed that I made a reference to the restatement second of contracts, section 202A, I think it is.
Well, if the wife can't appeal that.
Yes.
Section K says the only thing that a trial court can do is effectuate it.
That's correct.
He cannot change it.
And I wonder
how then today can the trial court say, well, I'm now going to give the wife the cost of living increases that the original order denied her?
So I think the court would be helped by my analysis, which was, I used to teach contract law, and so this was on my tongue the day that we were trying the case, and now I had to go back and find the source of it. In contract law, there's something called the one contract theory, which is in the restatement. And that's a rule of interpretation of contracts. So I think what you have to do is you have to look at the two documents together. This will be a case of first impression in Virginia. This issue has never come up like this before.
And what do we do with the potential inconsistencies between the two orders if we're following the
Absolutely.
Restatement rule of one contract?
Well, first of all, I don't think there is an inconsistency. I think the point is
Let's take her premise that there is, because you do have the first order, which sort of delineates a percentage, and the second order, which actually gives it dollar amount.
Well, and I know
which
she,
is different when you add them up. I mean, math's not my strong suit. That's why I went to law school.
I agree.
But
well, the appellate beat that drum to death. And if you look at the language the parties entered in the final decree, she takes one phrase out of a sentence and says that that's what the order means, and it's not at all what the order says. It doesn't say the wife gets 50% of the pension. That very sentence goes on to say that there's a date that's given of the date of separation, and there's going to be a formula that calculates her share of the pension.
The marital share is not in the, is not specifically in the decree.
No.
The marital share is the result of a calculation, typically.
Yes, that's correct.
But that number is not in the decree.
That's correct.
Now, go on with that.
Yes, yes. I'm excited about this, actually. I get
really?
To hear it. This is sort of like giving people the ingredients for making a dessert and not telling them. You can tell them what the ingredients are, but you don't tell them the measurements, and you don't tell them what method of cooking you have to use, and you don't tell them what the result has to be. And I don't usually write orders like this. I wrote this thing. But there was a reason, can't go into that, why this happened this way. But what we've done is we've given a group of ingredients, and we've said throughout this thing that the parties are going to calculate, there's going to be a formula, they're going to estimate a number that's not in here.
Even without the ingredients.
Yes.
The word in the decree that just emerges brightly is the marital share is part of that is to go to the wife.
Yes.
And the order specifies what part of the marital share. What also pops out is, I don't know what the marital share is if I just look at the decree.
So I was thinking
don't you have to deal with that first?
Well, I think the answer to that is this. If we could tell from the two documents together what the parties intended, then there isn't any ambiguity. But that what may give rise here is a question about whether there is ambiguity, and we have to go behind what's in the order, which is another big question that looms in this case. I'm sorry to have created this mess for you all.
But the answer to Judge Malvo's question, what do you do if it is perceived to be inconsistent? There's an inconsistency in the two documents under your one contract theory.
Well, if there is an inconsistency, and so by the way, back to the one contract rule, if it can be reconciled, then it should be reconciled. That's the whole point of that interpretation of contract law.
But there's no Virginia law that actually specifically addresses the one.
No, but Virginia has incorporated contract the whole of contract law. And I'm urging the court, I think you have a chance here to a first impression to tell us. I think, for example, you have a chance here, first impression, to tell us whether 2155 applies just to the final decree or also to the order that divides the pension. I think it does. There's nothing in 2155 that tells you that it doesn't apply to orders dividing pensions. Another premise I have, which I think is important, is suppose that you take her argument that the final decree is the be-all and end-all of what is to be in the next order. Well, something, even in that moment in time between the final decree and the entry of that order dividing the pension, has to accomplish that. And if the parties have agreed, how that should be done. In our case, clearly there had to be some formulation of the final order. And if that was done by agreement, you still have then an order that I think 2155 applies to and makes it a contract.
You're arguing this issue of first impression about the scope of subsection K.
Yes.
Doesn't subsection K gives the court authority to effectuate the order entered pursuant to this section, which is the equitable distribution order.
Yes, sir.
But doesn't by subsection 1, 2, 3, and 4, it specifically limit the trial court's authority as to exactly which portions of the ED order it can modify.
Yes, sir, I agree.
So it's not quite as broad as you seem to be suggesting it could do. It could revisit the entire ED order.
Well, I think it can't. I think it's even more limited than that. I think the whole point of 107.3K4 originally was, the legislative intent was, that you can, if there's a problem in that order so it can't be processed, it can be fixed.
In the retirement order, not the decree.
Right, only in the retirement order.
I thought, you know, you're not saying the decree can be modified.
No, well, so let me speak to that. If the court, so one of the judges asked me earlier about the question of how the orders could be entered after the 21 days. Well, there is a writ of error quorum vobis where the court could look behind the order to correct typographical errors, or if there was some kind of fraud, and I've suggested that in the trial. So, for example, one time I entered a final decree in Fredericksburg, I won't tell you which judge, and as he was signing the order, he accidentally entered the order 10 years after the event. He wrote the wrong date on the order. Well, clearly the parties didn't get divorced 10 years from now. So it was correcting an error that was contained in the order. So, for example, if you had order dividing pension that said you get 40% of the pension and the final decree said 50% of the pension, either there was a typographical error or there was fraud, duress, or some other thing happened, and the court always has the power to correct errors that are contained in its order.
There's no suggestion of any type of
error. And I'll tell you, that's an important point that I made at trial, is that there was no proof. And if I could just speak a couple of moments to the proof, there's so many more things I would love to say. Don't get to say them. But I would like to point out to the court that really we don't even get to the analysis, I don't think, in this case. I hope that you would, because I'd love to see what you have to say. But really, the appellant did not prove their case at trial. When Ms. Jackson testified, the only thing she said is, I got $1,053.39 starting when the order was entered, and I'm still getting that amount. That's all the testimony. There was no other effort to enter any testimony at all. And I wanted to go back to the Craig case, which the appellant's counsel tried, and which this court decided, because there was something really exciting that I found on page 28 of that order. It says, and this is the court analyzing what happened in the Craig case, we must first resolve whether the trial court erred in its determination of the party's intent before we can decide whether 2107K4.3K4 applies to allow the court to amend the order. In this case, that's what the trial judge was saying. You never told me what the parties intended. There's no evidence in the record that tells us what the parties meant by the final decree.
Why does the party's intent have anything to do with effectuating the final order? I can see the party's intent having something to do with entering and contents of the final order, but once that final order is entered, all the trial court can do is effectuate its terms.
That is what appellant claims. I'm saying to the court, the content of that order and interpretation of the content of that order is driven by what the parties intend.
In which order? The decree?
Both. I think it is relevant to both. What the parties intended is what drives the court. If both of these orders are agreements, and even if just the one is an agreement, we have to know what the parties intended. May I continue just a moment
I'll
finish this thought?
I'll give you just about 20 seconds to wrap it up, Ms. Worley.
Just to finish this thought, that the idea is, what the driving thing is, when the parties have an agreement, whether it's by a property settlement or a consent order as this was, the idea the court has posited and is replete in the law is that what the court's looking for is what the parties intended, not what DFAS might think the parties intended, but what did the parties intend? And there was no proof of what the parties intended and where that got off the rails.
Thank you, Mr. Worley.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Ms. Gervais?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And I'll start by trying to address Judge Petty's question about the 30 days of appeal. I think the jurisdiction remains under 20-107.3. I disagree that the second order is in any way a final appealable order. It is an order pursuant to Section K of that statute, and so there is ongoing jurisdiction to modify it.
Right.
Just briefly, I would address, in terms of counsel's argument that the court first has to determine what the intent of the parties is, the only evidence of that is the contract itself. That's what contract law says.
I was about to ask you, since you were in Craig, and since I was in Craig at the appellate level,
yes.
I thought the idea was what is the intent as can be seen, perceived, analyzed in the decree.
Correct.
First of all. First.
So there's no evidence to be presented of what their intent is. That's a matter of interpretation for the court in looking at the contract.
We're in contract now.
Exactly.
There is no single contract that the parties intend
exactly.
can be discerned other than in the document itself, you need parole evidence.
Correct. And I think it was clear from looking at the final decree that what the intent was to divide, give her 50% of the marital share. And then there is a description of how do we determine what this marital share is.
What is the marital share? Tell us, what are the components of the marital share?
The components of the marital share are the time frame, the time frame of his creditable service, the date of the marriage, the date of separation, and... that's it. I mean, that's how you determine the marital share. And
so where does the cost of living increases come into that equation?
I believe that although the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of Virginia has never said cost of living adjustments specifically are part of the benefit, that in the Zip versus Zip case, that can be inferred from that case. In that case, they talk about the fact that when you're giving a defined future benefit, You cannot reduce it to a fixed sum because that benefit changes. And I believe that that's an implication that includes the COLAs,
Your argument is that the payor of this pension is obligated to increase her portion by the cost of living increase and increase his portion by the cost of living increase.
May I respond?
You may respond.
That's exactly correct. Because otherwise what's happening is the person receiving the pension gets the benefit of the other side increase to their share. So I believe that that's something that goes with her marital share of the pension.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you so much.
Down and greet, Council.